You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
I'm Calvin, and you're listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. This show is an experiment in civility, gathering people who disagree to sit down face to face and having them discuss their disagreements. Do we ever arrive at consensus? Sometimes. What's most important is we've got the conversation started.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I'm your host, Calvin Moore. And per usual, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait and Steve Phelps. What's up, guys?
We're coming to you live today from the back of a pirate ship.
It does feel like a pirate ship.
It feels like a pirate ship.
Really?
Kind of.
Okay, so...
Or the cargo container on a non-pirate ship.
Okay, yeah. So we are...
Oil tanker.
Maybe an oil tanker.
Normally, when we record, we record in the studio in Royal Oak. But tonight, there is an event... at the Detroit Shipping Container in downtown Detroit, where I guess we're meeting the restaurant owners and things here. And so Dave asked shows if they wanted to come down and record. And I said, sure, we'll come down and record. I think we were the only one who said we would. But we get to talk
game
to people and get food afterwards, which is kind of fun. So anyway, we are recording inside what used to be a shipping container. It's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm prepared to be carried away at any second. They attached the crane.
I saw this place being built when they did it, but it was kind of cool. Either way, we are downtown, and we are going to be doing a panel discussion about, it's going to be titled, Are Black Women Being Left Behind? And this just kind of comes out of several conversations I've had with a number of people on Facebook, particularly black women. And I said, you know what? It would be, I mean, Facebook can only go so far, right? Maybe we're missing each other in translation, or I didn't totally get what you meant and you didn't get what I meant. I'd like to have this conversation face to face. And so we have got a few women and one man brave enough, as you said, off air.
Technically, like three or four guys here.
Yeah, well, true story, but we're hosts. So
three of us work here.
We're the wallpaper.
We can ask incendiary questions and then just back off. It's just a question. Reading what's on the paper.
There's a door right here for me.
So we've got four great guests tonight. And I'm going to go ahead and read their bios, and you guys can say hello. But first up, we have – I always feel like I'm going to mispronounce your last name. It's Tati Amara.
Amara.
Yeah. I always get that wrong. Okay. Tati Amara. Tati Amara is a recent transplant. Well, not so recent anymore,
yeah,
I guess.
It's been three years now.
Well, I just
– That's okay.
I got the old bio here. is a transplant to the Detroit area, born in Addis Ababa, mm-hmm. Ethiopia.
East Africa. In the building.
Okay. Yeah. Raised in Los Angeles and New York.
Yes.
Right? Tati got her stripes in Brooklyn.
Yes.
She's an award-winning producer, serves as a co-host of WDIV4. Is it still live in the D?
Yes.
It's still live in the D. All right.
I knew I recognized your name. I knew it.
It's just me.
Okay. a program that gives a relentlessly positive view of the city of Detroit. She's had experience both in front of the camera and behind the scenes. Tati, thanks so much for being on today.
Thank you for having me.
Also, no stranger to our line, Miss Talisa Cohen is back. Talisa Cohen is an IT professional, entrepreneur, and licensed realtor. She's devoted the last 17 years working in the field of information technology at a financial services company headquartered in St. Petersburg, Florida, but she's here in Detroit, of course. She's held positions ranging from a help desk support technician to project manager to technology training program coordinator, technology consultant, and analyst. Talisa, thanks so much for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Next up.
All these people are going to be trying to give her their resume. I was feeling sorry for her as soon as you said that.
Welcoming back to the line, Mr. L. Michael Gibson. L. Michael Gibson's award-winning writer and educator and an art, youth, LGBTQ rights and public health advocate. For both government and various national and grassroots nonprofits, Gibson has worked as a consultant and senior administrator on issues focused on HIV/AIDS, LGBTQ advocacy, creative entrepreneurship, adolescent and sexual reproductive health, and community development programming over his 23 years in public service. Michael, welcome back.
Glad to be back. Now 25 years.
25 years. Yeah, see, I got to update. I have a master bio sheet, so I got to update the years for everybody, I guess. And then also, last but not least, Miss Brahinda Williams. Brahinda Williams lives her life in color. Williams is a bilingual. I'm going to try to get this word right. Femolutionary.
That is correct.
All right. Who lives according to her name's meaning, the bare-hearted protector of multiculturalism, art, and womanhood. Brahinda is the founder of The Power of Girlhood, a teen mentoring program for girls, and the CEO of the Wisdom Institute. She's also penned a book of bilingual poetry and essays, memoirs of the human experience, and everything in between. Brahinda, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So let's dive right into questions then. What are some of the biggest issues facing black women in America today, in your opinion? Also, I guess I'm just going to say it. We do also have someone here taking pictures, Miss Nia. If there's something you really want to say, hop on the mic, because there's one right in front of you. But she's here, she's taking pictures here.
And that, Michael, is why I'm wearing the blazer.
Somebody new.
I got my polo on.
I should have said there's going to be a photographer there. I always look good. Anyway, what are some of the biggest issues facing black women today in America?
So I guess I'll start. Yes. One of the things that I noticed while this movement for diversity and inclusion is happening in corporate America specifically, I feel like black women are still not being considered as much as I would like to see. There is a movement for minority men and other minority groups, but still when you look at top-level management, there's still an underrepresented population, and that's us, African-American women. So I think that's the biggest issue I see today still.
Okay.
I would also like to chime in, too. Before they become women, I'd like to see more involvement with girls. I think that there is, there are obviously organizations that do it, but what ends up happening a lot of times, from my observation, they're like dreams deferred. So women come in, and so there's sort of this, I have to tell you how to do it, versus letting the space be open. And I think that the more a girl has an opportunity to see a woman, which goes back to your point that their representation is not there, there has to be like the symbiotic relationship. So in order for her to get there, she has to be groomed to get there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think that the unfortunate thing is that society is structured in such a way that we've been given these strict rules of conduct, of what's right, of what's wrong. This is how you behave. This is how you have to move in the world as a black girl, as a black woman, if you want to be respected, taken seriously, and want to get to where you're supposed to be. So there are all these rules kind of crushing you. And I'm not going to say that there's no validity to those rules. They're based on and have been constructed in response to how people perceive us when we move around. Black girls are always perceived to be hypersexual,
yes,
perceived to be more aggressive, get suspended from school at a higher rate than any other racial group, white, Hispanic, or Latino, Latina, whatever you want to say, Asian. It's us. So there, you know, you're fighting two things, right? You're fighting being able to move around in the world safely, but still be yourself, still not have your hopes and your dreams crushed. And it's just a lot of that has been as a response to just survival for us. So,
okay. Gibson, your thoughts?
Yeah. So, I recently wrote an essay that's going to be out in Dr. Kenitra Brooks' Lemonade Reader on Black women, feminism, and respectability politics. And much of what is said here is echoed in the essay. Part of what drove my analysis or the essay was that Black women consistently had all of these kind of big wins. So most educated, even beating out Asian women, less likely to have pregnancy now, you know, 25-year declines in teenage birth rates, teenage pregnancy rates. And still these labels persist, you know, most likely to be religious, most likely to say spirituality is important in their lives, still considered immoral, you know. And so, but I also want to challenge Black women to not partake in their own oppression, because some of the biggest advocates of these types of ideas of fast girls and black women ain't this and black women ain't that are other black women.
Patriarchy is perpetuated by women, not by men. Yeah. Women are the gatekeepers of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, back to that piece about projection I was saying, is that when you come in, you know, they're tender. So squashing them and telling them that, you know, this isn't professional or this is, I think there needs to be a space for girls to express their truth in a way that is not judgmental. Because at one point you were also that girl. And in many cases, you probably also walked that same footstep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I also want to piggyback on what you brought up around numbers. I actually have some data real quick. So black women comprise only 8% of the private sector jobs, despite being the most educated, and only 1.5% of leadership roles. They're also fewer than 4% of women of color, not just black women, but women of color, in executive and official managers at SP 500 companies. Also, despite the fact that they're more likely to pay their mortgage on time, so I'm the least likely to get their mortgage approved. Mm. So that even when you're doing it right, you know, and the last one is everybody knows 61 cents for every dollar a white man makes takes black women 19 months to earn the same amount of money that a white man of comparable education will earn in 12. Wow. So.
I almost growled.
And that's when the entire Detroit shipping container burned to the ground. Okay, let's
go. On the plus side, when Roseanne got fired, it was a black woman who did
That's right.
Yeah.
True story. Some wins.
She also was the one who hired her, though.
Yeah, true story. Oh, ooh, yeah, they came back on. Okay.
Some people have suggested that black women are the, quote, most unprotected and disrespected segment in America. The new Surviving R. Kelly docuseries on Lifetime seems to be bringing this issue into greater focus. Do you have any thoughts on that sentiment?
Where do you begin? I mean...
Probably with I Believe I Could Fly.
Yeah. Or not.
I believe that I hope you crash and burn. I recently came across a video that had gone viral on Twitter. I'm sure a lot of you have seen it. If you haven't, look it up. It's of a woman going to buy gas at a gas station, and she is surrounded by a pack of wolves who wouldn't even let her walk. Did you see it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Who's seen it? You've seen it? It's disturbing.
Mm-hmm. I did it without the volume on.
You would be even more disturbed. So I didn't even know where to begin with that. Excuse my ignorance, but I don't know of any other culture where women have to deal with that kind of harassment. Did you see it?
I didn't see it, but it's my life.
Okay. Mm. Mm. So let's just start with that. Why is this even acceptable? Yeah. Why are all of you complicit in it? We'll get to that part of it with the R. Kelly situation, because mm-hmm. he did not make that happen on his own.
Right.
And instead of, there wasn't one man in that group who said, yo, chill, what are you doing?
Same thing with the McDonald's situation.
Yes. Yes. Not one man. So what does that say? I think like all of these examples that we see, unfortunately, on social media going viral, are of examples where no one stands up for these women, not one single person.
I wonder, is that a byproduct of this whole no snitching, you know, kind of going hand in hand with the no snitching and kind of, you know, it's not my business. Mm-hmm. Too much, you know, too much of that in our community where I feel like we used to be this village, you know, type community where that was the idea. Everybody looked out for one another. And now it's more me, myself, and I, or mine. And, you know, I'm just going to mind my business. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I'll tell you a couple things from, I mean, I want to give my perspective on why I think certain people hold back. And then I also want to read something from a book that I read last year for another episode that we did. But for me, because of the way I was raised, like I was raised in a Christian household, I was taught how to be a gentleman. That, you know, guys hold, you know, some people call it antiquated, but, you know, I like old style stuff. Yeah, chivalry, right? So, you know, hold doors, you know, for ladies and don't expect anything. You know, take a young lady out to dinner and don't expect anything that, other than a nice time, mm-hmm. right? That's what you do. And so when I started hearing that these things happen to women, like, oh, you know, women are sexually harassed all the time and catcalled. I'm like, whatever. And then I saw the video of the girl walking down the street in New York.
Yes.
Not saying anything and getting catcalled. I was like, this happens. And for me, I think there are certain people who don't want to believe it because that's not them. Like, it's just not me to do those things. So when someone says, this happens, and it happens consistently. Like, I want to say, oh, that was a one-off. That was that one dude. He was an asshole. Mm-hmm. But you just said a few moments ago, Brenda, it's my life, right? I didn't need to watch the video. It's my life. So I think there's that perspective. It doesn't happen because I'm not that kind of person personally, right? Yeah. But then I read something last year in a book called Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. It's a book by Kate Harding. And she says this. She's talking about rape myths. She says, quote, rape myths vary among societies and cultures. However, they consistently follow a pattern whereby they blame the victim for their rape, express a disbelief in the claims of rape, exonerate the perpetrator, and allude that only certain types of women are raped. Rape myths, like all myths, are designed to serve up psychological comfort, not hard facts. As Grubb and Turner put it, to believe that rape victims are innocent and not deserving of their fate is incongruous with the general belief in a just world. Therefore, in order to avoid cognitive dissonance, rape myths serve to protect an individual's belief in a just world, unquote. So there's this idea that we're walking around with like these Pollyanna-ish glasses, these rose-colored glasses, that the world is great, everything is fine. The world, it's like that the meme of the dog sitting in the room and everything's on fire, and he's like, this is fine, right? And so I think that that might be in play here, is we don't want to admit that the world is on fire. We just want to say that everything's okay. And so when that's happening to women, we know it's happening, but we need to keep this illusion alive for ourselves. That's just perspective that I've gotten after reading what she's written and then also coming from the background I came from.
So then what are we waiting for? Right. What needs to happen before people realize that this is a problem? I saw a video on Facebook. I think it was in Detroit, where a woman decided to pull her phone out and start recording and kind of like live streaming what all of these, it was the beauty parlor, you know, the beauty shop on a Saturday.
Oh boy.
A lot of action up in there for those of you who know, right? A lot of, we philosophize, you figured out all the problems in the world.
Boosters make them.
Yeah. Get you a scarf, get you a seat. Yeah, you have all kinds of stuff, right? New handbag.
I walked in with some pies.
Yes,
we're good. We're good.
Yes. Lunch.
Salads and bundles.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Salads and bundles.
Salads and bundles. Some fried fish, like maybe. I could go get you some. You know how it goes. So
I know like our white listeners right now are like, that doesn't happen at Barcelona.
Right.
I haven't been to a barber in a while, so I don't even know.
Does that happen, Karen?
Leave a potato salad out of this.
Oh, hell no, Karen. All right. Continue. I'm sorry.
The whole cultural experience, you know. So as per usual, the whole R. Kelly documentary comes up. And you could see the generational gap. Did you see the video?
No.
Okay. So the older black women, you already know what they were saying. You want to finish it for me? Because I know you can.
No.
I know you can.
I can't.
They were saying, how you know it happened?
Oh.
Those girls were fast. Mm. And the young girl was like, no, I don't think you understand. He was brainwashing them. You know, she's trying to.
So that was the women saying that, because I've heard that from the men.
It was,
but I've heard
older
from the
women.
Younger generation of girls saying that those girls should have known better. And that was really troubling, hearing girls. Not,
really?
Yes, saying that what were they thinking? They should have left. They should have kicked him in his you-know-what.
It's not that simple.
Yeah. And I thought that was very interesting coming from 16, 17-year-old girls.
So they put their responsibility back on the girls. They do it with the parents. I mean, with Nassar at mm-hmm. Michigan State University, people were like, why did the parents keep taking the kids to this same guy when there's like hundreds of thousands of, complaints? Well, not hundreds of thousands, but many, many complaints about the same person.
Yeah. And to avoid, you know, going over ground that it's been gone over a lot in the last year and a half, the most vociferous defenders of the president heard with all of these sexual harassment complaints were women.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, so to your point around rape culture and our need to blame the victims, I mean, one out of four women, one out of two black women, mm-hmm. one out of six men, to say that it's not the norm, I think at this point is a stretch. I think I think that's what people are trying to avoid, to really receive and accept that this is not the exception. Mm-hmm. Those are really high numbers and probably undercounts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so especially the one in six men, right? Because how many of those men are actually willing to fess up?
Yeah.
You know, I do think that when Zora Neale Hurston said, black women are the mule of the earth, that still is the truth today. Most unprotected in this respect, I think it's hard to argue with. However, also, you know, I heard some people say, well, if these were white girls or these were white women, and I'm like, have you not been paying attention to Me Too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because
Harvey Weinstein.
You know, Harvey Weinstein, you know, or if these were young boys, I'm like, have you not paying attention to what just recently happened with Ed Buck?
So this
having
is like in everybody's backyard.
You're right.
Yeah, on everybody's lawn, everybody's front yard.
You're right.
So like, no one's exempt. This is equal opportunity.
No one is exempt.
Well, we may not have equity in other places. Guess what? You too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I think
in
the
this
scariest
case, they just want to see some sort of punishment, you know, because we're talking about it. The conversation is happening, but where are the consequences?
But do they want to see punishment? Yeah.
Well, his sales have spiked. I saw that recently ago that in airing the documentary, which I'm
almost
sure
20%.
That's not what she wanted, but there was a spike in record sales.
Well, is that maybe because it reminded, and this is just, you know, middle-aged white guy talking here, is it maybe because it reminded people who R. Kelly was? he disappeared for me for 20 years.
Not for black people.
No, I guess.
Not for
black people. That's the thing.
Babies are still being made.
I mean, Black Dynasty sold 200,000 copies within this first few
months. If you asked me to name a second R. Kelly song, I couldn't do it.
How, he was the remix master. Yeah. Like, okay. In the 90s, like, that was his thing. Everybody wanted an R. Kelly
Which I admit
remix.
Says more about me and my musical stylings than it does about the Billboard chart. Yeah. But okay.
It is hard to stand on principle, though, because that music, it, I mean, he, you know, his music is good. It was, you know, yeah, but it's like, you know, it's
Soul
the principle.
Train? Wasn't he, like, honored on Soul Train, like, 2 years was ago he? When Erica Badu, they did the whole backyard
I
thing?
Know it wasn't long ago.
Well, it wasn't that long
after.
Ago.
I think yeah. that what we're possibly running into here is something that we all do naturally is we try to focus on the good or separate the good from the bad that a person does, right? Yeah. Case in point, I don't watch wrestling anymore, but I grew up watching Hulk Hogan, and then he dropped the N-word, and then he was erased from the WWE, and then Mean Gene Okerlund died a couple days ago, and they always had like a little rapport on the show. He showed up back on WWE on Monday as a tribute. And like everybody had forgotten what had happened. So I wonder if we put people out to pasture for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Chris Brown.
Give them their little punishment and then let them come back. Because
Mel Gibson's back. If Mel Gibson can come
right,
back.
Right. I think there's a desire to punish, but also an unwillingness to give up the nostalgia we have with a particular person, particularly when it comes to the black community. Because we're like, we have so few wins. We have so few wins. So when Bill Cosby was out here drugging all these women, like, that's Cliff Huxtable. Yeah. Like, no, Cliff Huxtable is Cliff Huxtable. That's a character he played. Bill Cosby was drugging women. He's like, yeah, but he was also giving a lot of money to the black community and making sure that people went to college and yada, yada, yada. And so we have so few wins when we find out that our people in our community are doing bad things as well.
Generally, we want it. We want a good guy. Our quote unquote good black guy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We want to excuse the bad.
Right.
I wonder if it is too though. Is
which is detrimental to this particular conversation we're having about how black women are treated because they're at the end of that particular conversation with Bill Cosby and R. Kelly. Here,
I wonder if we divide up that constant dividing up of the art and the artist. You know, we if we love an art, we're willing to forgive the artist a lot of times, unfortunately. We were just talking about this the other day. Why are there certain artists we can separate and why some we can't? Kevin Spacey, I think people have a hard time separating because when he's delivering a line, you see his face. You think you know who Kevin Spacey is. If it's R. Kelly, you go back. I mean, what R. Kelly did is nothing that Steven Tyler didn't do. It's nothing that... You know,
David Bowie
didn't do with both young men and young women.
And when David Bowie died, it wasn't just sadness. He was a saint.
Right, exactly. And so you see, you know, these artists from the 60s and 70s and 80s who we laugh about it now. But they were doing things with 12 and 13-year-old girls backstage that are now praised as, well, just rock and roll. What are you going to do? But R. Kelly does it now. Now it's different. And I think there is a little bit of that nostalgia and that you can separate the art from the artist when they're 30 and 40 years ago. But right now, you know, the artist is right in our face. And so, you know, they're the one and the same. But I don't know why we look back on stuff that happened 30 years ago and say, well, that was just a different time.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard these arguments and I want to make sure I'm not taking up too much space because there's a lot of women in the room. But one, we don't just do it around art and artists. No, the rape documentary by Shahida Simmons, if you've not seen it, you should, is about black women being raped by prominent black men and how the community rallies around those men consistently. And they're not just in art. They're in politics. They're in academia. They're in corporate America. Yeah. That anytime a black man is winning, we give him license. And we don't want to hold him accountable. And the black church is really strongly culpable in that respect. It was the black church who rallied around Mike Tyson when the Desiree rape charge came about. You know, and we've seen this again, even with R. Kelly having been surrounded by clergy and some of the images that we've seen. The art and the artist separation thing, I think in R. Kelly's situation, though, it becomes difficult to say. It's so many charges. It's so heinous. It's so bad, right? Like, I mean, I think we have other artists. David Ruffin beat the hell out of his wife, beat the hell out of Tammy Terrell, terrorized his son. We still buy Temptations albums. Nobody's stopping that. But I think that the R. Kelly thing is also fresh We're not talking about 30, 40 years ago. Right. We're talking today, right now.
But to your point, I think you're layering out years of dismissal.
Mm-hmm.
It's come to a head. You know, so I think that R. Kelly is now going to sort of be the one to take the lashings for, you know, as you were saying, David Ruffin and some of the other artists. It's like, okay, so now we need a whipping boy to now absorb all of this mistreatment and all of this bad behavior. And so his number's up.
So let's move on to the celebrity thing and just talk about men in general.
All right. Well, yeah. All right. So let's talk about black men for a minute. In what ways do you feel black women are being protected by black men? In what ways do you feel black women are being disrespected by black men?
That question about how we're being respected is tough for me because I just don't feel like I see a lot of that happening. But the disrespect, still, I know, going back to the art and music and the way we're represented in rap and R&B in particular. You know, it's just like we're so objectified and, you know, it really seems like we're given license to be treated poorly in exchange for money. And that is the idea that is being perpetuated in the music, in the videos, and I think that it's having an effect in situations like the R. Kelly situation. And the people form opinions based off of, like, it's like, well, they wanted it. You know, they were just trying to have a come up, kind of. So.
Okay.
When no one actually comes up.
Right.
No one comes up. No one gets rich. I think that, like, sometimes I hesitate when I feel like I'm turning into one of those old people who's like, it's that daggone rap music. Ruining these kids. What you listening to? But I mean, I blush now sometimes, you know, when a good song comes on the radio, I was kind of into the beat, like, oh, this is a bop. Oh, what? What are you talking about? And I mean, imagine young, impressionable minds absorbing this kind of information. You can't do anything. I can't imagine us doing anything healthy and positive. I believe that whatever you take in starts to change you from the inside.
I tell my daughters that all the time. I'm like, and my sons actually. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you think it's just music.
Right.
But over time, it desensitizes you and it changes your idea of what's acceptable. And it gives you an image of what you should be striving to be.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I hate to sound like one of those old people too, because I like to turn my music up, you know, and ride. But I'm like, this music is awful.
Exactly. The lyrics are horrible.
I am now that I've embraced my, I have come to a realization that I am the TT that you come to when your ass gets in a sling. Mm. I am not cool.
Right.
I am not your friend.
Right.
We'll handle it. We'll fix it, but we'll be in that uncomfortable car ride home where you're like, I'm just like, just. I've gotten there with the eye contact. I'm not even verbal anymore.
Right. The stare. It might be one of these.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, I'll knock you in. I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm quoting my mother.
Right.
But I think that there's some validity in that and some necessity in that. When you listen to these songs, and I ask if you listen to these songs all day, every day, it starts to wire itself into your subconscious. So if you're listening to this in the morning and throughout the day and before you go to sleep at night, there's something that's a rewiring that's happening to you. Because when you want to learn something, what do they say? Well, you have to do it by repetition. Mm-hmm. Well, this is also, unfortunately, like an anti-learning that's happening. And I mean, look what's happening to your mind, your behavior, your aggression. I have one student, she comes to me, she suffers a lot from anxiety and depression. And so I turned her on to some Claude Debussy. So she's listening.
Claire de Lune.
Claire de Lune and Afternoon of the Fawn. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's some culture people.
Yes, okay. So, because she's really having a bad day, I say, okay, here, sweetie, you can go sit in my chair. She puts her headphones. She was like, I never knew that this would calm me. Like, I never listened to classical music. Who'd have thunk that? She was like, I feel so calm right now. I'm like, imagine that. So now imagine if you would do this on a repeated basis. And then I asked her, I said, well, let me see your phone. Like, what's in your playlist? It's like, I'm gonna ignore all the pictures because, you know, like I said, I'm not cool. I'm going to ignore all the pictures that are in here. But when I looked at the playlist.
Yeah. And then there's nothing to counteract. You have to have a balance at least.
You know what's kind of funny about it, not to make a joke of this, but a couple days ago, I was listening to Cardi B's new song, Money.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Is that the one, F from Then I Get Some Money?
No, that's the other one.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it is that one, too. There was a point in the song where she talks about sleeping in leather pajamas, and I went on Facebook like, who the hell sleeps in leather pajamas? It just sounds like really uncomfortable. And then like 4 days later, I'm Googling like leather pajamas. Uh-huh. Like that That could be interesting. I don't know what would that be like. Maybe I'll buy some leather pajamas at some point, right? And so, but no, just case in point is like, hey, you know, this is a way that music can influence you, because I've been listening to this song over and over because it's got a great beat. But then I'll have my daughter in the car, and like, she'll be jamming to the words, and then all of a sudden I'm paying attention. I'm like, oh, oh shoot! But then there, this is where the pushback comes on this particular conversation, because there's a video that came out a few years ago where there was a young lady who confronted the president or the then president of BET. And she said, don't you feel culpable putting all this garbage out there that is denigrating to the black community, especially to women? Mm-hmm. And he said, the reason we do it is because you keep buying it. Like, right. If you didn't buy it, we wouldn't sell it. Right, that's how it works.
The chicken or the egg. Right. I mean, and it's like there's nothing to counter balance it. And I love how people, like, in those power positions, they can just write, well, that's what I'm giving the people what they want.
Right.
But
give them another choice.
Them another choice. And that's the scary part. What other culture has music like ours? Answer that question for me.
I'm going to be the guy in the room that's going to have a contrary. So I've been a music journalist for 16 years. I've been working in this culture in the industry for a long time. I am 44 next week. And if I look around the room, most of y'all was around me partying to DMX years, partying to Jay-Z's early years, our hip-hop music has always had misogynistic lyrics. Hip hop music has always had homophobic lyrics. Hip hop music has always had, and not everyone ended up going to jail. Not everyone ended up disrespecting women. Not everyone ended up homophobic. I'm gay, and I played nothing but DMX when I would work out in the gym because it would help me get through my workout much more.
We had the old school music.
We had the balance.
There was balance
of both. But then I have to go, and this is where I may sound like the old man. I had a balance because my mom was playing that music when I was. My mom played her generation's music. She played my grandmother's generation's music. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that I was just relying on a radio for the balance. And then today you have, I mean, one of the things that independent artists and veteran artists who've recently put out trap albums in the last 2 years have said is because y'all wouldn't buy the album. I mean, even R. Kelly's Write Me Back in Love Letters, which were like these throwback albums that were like romantic and didn't denigrate women. And he followed, those albums did not sell. He came out with Black Panties. It sold 200,000 copies in a month.
That's scary.
Which was more than one of those albums did in its entire run. And so, and Black Panties, for those who don't know, is like one of the worst albums you'll ever want to hear about black women. There's a review of mine in SoulTracks.com about it from 2014. It is horrible.
Shameless plug.
No, I mean, plug it, because I never heard of it, and I will probably be traumatized by the album Black Panties.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, I remember my cousin telling me about going to a show back in the day and before I was partying, when it was like Public Enemy and, I don't know, like Ice Cube or something like that. But you had such, that wasn't abnormal. Like, the two could coexist. Mm-hmm. There's so very little positive hip hop. Forget the stuff that like our parents played, right?
Right.
You know, we're not talking about Anita Baker and Sade and stuff like that. We're talking about, you know, for hip hop. Who was like, okay, J. Cole?
Kendrick.
Yeah. Kendrick. Kendrick gets a little slick in the mouth as well. Come on, lady. Yeah. A little something, you know.
J. Cole can get homophobic.
Yes, exactly. So,
now you do have people that are, I mean, they started off doing your explicitly Christian stuff, but now they've kind of moved more into cultural positive rap. Like, you got your Lecrae's, you got your Nomis, you've got your Triple's, your Tadashi's, your Andy Mineo's. You've got these people who are doing your positive things, and some of them are breaking barriers. Like, Lecrae's gotten a bunch of Grammys now, and he's hobnobbing with Kendrick Lamar and those kinds of people. But yeah, the sheer amount of trash. Trash that's out there.
It's trash.
Yeah.
Well, though
I don't listen to trap or trap, so let it get trash.
I have to wonder though.
Well,
so
I can't understand it. Right.
If music, I guess, is your primary influence, then you're gonna be more influenced than if you're like, all right, so your mom was playing certain things, but you had a lot going on. Now, if you had strong figures in your life that influenced who you are, the music is gonna be something that's on the periphery. It's not gonna be the center of the universe. Primary. But if you don't have another influence that's as strong as the music, it's going to influence you even more. So that kid that may not be misogynistic at first, but all they have is this one artist or this one type of music that they like, this one album, whatever it might be, they're going to be severely influenced by that one piece of art. But if you're well-rounded, you can listen to the good beat, and you're going to funnel that away and say, you know what? And then you're also probably going to grow out of it, though, too. You're going to say, boy, right. That was me at 16, but that's not me at 25.
Right.
But there are some people that get locked in, and that's who they become who they are.
Now, Gibson, I just want to take a second to explain how my experience was a lot like your experience with DMX. You were a young gay man who listened to DMX because it helped you get through your workout. I once saw DMX in an airport. That's literally the end of the story.
So let's switch gears.
Moving
here.
On.
This is why I keep Kent around. All right. So do you think black women have to navigate the workplace differently?
Yes.
Or the same? Or
oh, absolutely. Totally.
Okay. So I have heard in the last few years, especially as we get into the Me Too movement, we talk about the pay gap and things like that. That women in general have to navigate the workplace differently than their male counterparts. Do black women have to navigate the workplace differently than their white female counterparts? Or are you all in solidarity together in that situation?
Oh my goodness,
I'm not a black. I'm not a black woman.
What was that?
And I'm not in a corporate setting.
Thing that was circulating. You know, what's too much for the workplace now? I would say as a curvy, on the curvier side, I wouldn't have worn the dress, but the fact that we're even having the conversation.
Was it the teacher?
It was the teacher. You know, was that appropriate? Scrubs, you know, I've seen it. So it's like I've had conversations with my girlfriends about, oh, okay, well, I can't wear this or I can't wear that. Or I have to mute the tone so that I'm not offensive. So it's always this like internal dialogue that you're having with yourself, or even sometimes calling the tribunal together. Like, girl, is this appropriate for me to wear to work? Because you know how they are. Or even watching proximity at work.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in water cooler conversations, and I'm like, okay, it's just two of us, but if a third person joins, it's kind of like this inside joke. Well, we don't want them to think we're planning anything.
Right.
Because too many of us huddled together looks like we're
what are you up to over there?
Exactly.
Right, okay.
But we can't just be having a conversation about, I don't know, Debussy, possibly.
By the way, when you brought Debussy up before, my first thought was, oh, what did he do now? He's dead. I get it. Yeah. But I was thinking, who did he abuse?
He just rolled over.
Yeah.
That's all. Just rolling. I just find that that's a constant conversation. And that's just even like on the surface, but even sometimes our tone in emails, like, okay, how am I coming across? Because I don't want to be perceived as too aggressive.
Yes.
You know, how do I soften this or manage my messaging to get a point across? And it's like, you know, sometimes you have to call it what it is, but you're always kind of in your mind, always playing back, playing forward. And it's exhausting to always be in the space of being misunderstood.
And Tati, on this question, I think you might have the added element of being on television. Mm-hmm. Like, I just listened to Ellen DeGeneres. She just did her new stand-up, and she talks about how she can't do anything wrong because she's like, somebody cut me off, and I honked at them, and they were like, Ellen? She's the nicest person, right? That's she's the one who dances, right? Yeah. And so you're navigating a workplace. You've got an office. I've been in your office, but you're also on television every single morning. Mm-hmm. Is there another dynamic of how you have to operate being in kind of a celebrity world and then also being a black woman in a corporate setting?
There are so many things. I think that we're always confronted
without getting yourself in trouble, of course.
I know. Right? Like, let me think this through.
I love Channel 4.
Love my job. They're the unconscious biases that other people have that you're always challenging. They don't even know what they're doing because this is normal to them. We can start with everything from, I was afraid they were going to ask me to straighten my hair, and I was going to have to wear my hair straight for work. But they're okay with it. Mm-hmm. But there are these little things that you see with people, and honestly, fortunately, not in my immediate circle, and I'm not just saying that, people that I have to deal with, but you do encounter it with certain people sometimes, and you're like, you really think you know me. Like, you really think you've got me figured out, and you don't even know the tip of the iceberg. There is the fear of not wanting to make black people look bad on TV. I'm just going to say it. I said it. It's recorded. It's out there. There. I said
you
it.
Do us well.
Thank you. Thank you. But there is that thing, you know, there's the whole, you never want to come across as the angry black woman, you know, and it can be that with just my normal tone. Sometimes it comes across, it's tone. It's just like tone. You said, and it may not be an email. I am a little aggressive. I live the majority of my life in New York City. Sometimes I'll, you know, and I've been working on that, and it's important in the workplace. It's important with friendships and personal relationships and everything else. So it's something that I've been cultivating and working on, but you are always navigating respectability politics when you move around at work, at the grocery store, when you cut someone off in traffic. I mean, I could go on and on.
And when I send an email and it's straightforward, I'm being assertive.
Yes.
I'm being professional. I'm being assertive. And I'm being a leader.
Yes.
And that's the difference. I can do that.
And I was thinking,
let me do that.
if there's one emotion growing up in Detroit since I was 7 years old, when I first became aware of who this person was, if there's one emotion I associate with Chuck Gatica, it is unrestrained, passionate anger.
And hair that never moves.
God, I hate you, Kent. All right.
First of all, that's my boy. So
my brother graduated from high school with his son.
His son?
Yeah.
Now, this might not be popular to say, but, you know, when you're working in or trying to get work and promotions and things like this, I feel like when you're attractive, you have a bit of a competitive advantage. And then for, you know, black women, I feel like we're even more challenged in that regard, because the idea of what is beautiful and what is attractive is not typically us. So it's like, geez, like, I don't stand a chance. I mean, I don't have that problem. No.
But then there's that.
I didn't even think about that part, right? The whole, yeah, what is, you know, we did an entire panel talking about, is black beautiful? And so just kind of the beauty standards and things like that. I didn't even think about that in the workplace.
Do you wash your hair every day?
Yeah.
Wow, I've never gotten that
do
one.
Do you? I knew you haven't.
No. Well, I mean, now I do. I mean, but I mean, I'm wearing dreads again, so.
Okay.
Yeah. Your hair was short last week. Like, so how did you do that?
I have so asked that question. I feel bad about it now.
So he didn't know that my mom wears wigs. Okay. Right. And nope. She's very open about her wigs, and she loves changing
not
them
not that
up.
Open.
Well, in our circle, she is.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and in black culture, you know, she comes in one week, she's got short hair and it's blonde. Right. And the next week, she's got long, curly hair. You know,
go, mom.
It's a wig, right?
Right. Get it, mom.
Right. Get it, mom.
She had been on the show a few times.
And
she came. She came in different wigs, and he like reintroduced himself to her.
One time.
I'm Kent.
One time I reintroduced myself.
He's like, oh. You're Calvin's mom.
Yeah.
She's wearing a different wig.
Well, usually the wigs were the same color.
True story.
Usually. Right. Okay.
It's just a big joke on you, Kent.
I just never thought about that aspect of things in terms of navigating work. Because, yes, women who are objectively beautiful by, you know, white beauty standards in America, were like, oh, there's questions among men when she gets that promotion. Like, you know, she was doing something because she's hot and the guy was clearly attracted to her. But when it comes to black beauty, you could have an objectively beautiful black woman, but because you're not thought of as beautiful in the classic sense, that wouldn't be advantageous to you in a
not
in a
that
corporate
we should
setting.
Want just, it to be, but
right, I mean, right. right. Like, you shouldn't want it to be, but it's still kind of like, come on now, right?
I mean, whatever the age,
it's still an insult,
yeah.
Right? It shouldn't be based on that. Promotion should not be based on beauty. It should be based on merit, right? Yeah. You know, and what you can do. But even then, there's still an insult in it, because this is the way things sometimes work.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't work this way, but we're going to insult you in a process that's already shitty.
Right.
So it's – sorry for my language. I tend to have some salty language here.
I think it's interesting for me as a black man and has been in a workplace. I work for myself now full time, so I don't have to deal with these things. But when I did have to deal with them – what I also saw that black women supported black men's advancement, and if there was solidarity, the solidarity was black women towards the black male coworker.
Oh, yeah.
I did not see solidarity between white women and black women. I just did not. But I did not always see that in return, right? Like, so if, you know, Becky started crying because Charmaine had gotten assertive and, you know, Becky decided to weaponize her tears, you know, DeAndre wasn't like, that's bullshit.
Right. DeAndre, you know, went to lunch.
DeAndre went and got Kleenex for Becky, right? Like, and so I think when we talk about respect
in the workplace, if there's a way brothers could be better and should be better, is how are you advocating and supporting Black women in the workplace? Because I know for a fact a lot of my career was supported and advanced because of Black women's support. So,
Weaponize Her Tears, great album title. Mental note.
Well, I think that's a good place to break. We'll come back and we will talk about the advancement of Black women in academia and the workplace beyond this last question. So we'll be back in 10. Well, everybody, we are back from break, and we're going to dive right into the next question. So we mentioned this on the front end of the show, but Black women are graduating high school, attending college, participating in the labor force, and starting businesses at higher rates, but they still aren't seeing the rewards of their hard work, according to a report from the Black Women's Roundtable, which is the women's initiative of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. So even with adapting to academia or adapting to the workplace, even with the degrees and the qualifications, why do you think Black women lag behind?
Well, I think it's like what you were saying earlier about the workplace. I think we're still lagging behind because of identity and perceived threat, lack of, as we were talking about over the break, emotional labor. There are certain things that show up when something that is different than what you're used to shows up. You have to confront yourself. Some people choose not to. Most people choose not to because you have to sit in your own discomfort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, questions being asked. For example, I speak Spanish. I had a colleague ask me, so you're fluent. If I'm here in the capacity as a teacher, I didn't ask you, German teacher, if you're fluent. I don't ask the chemistry teacher. Okay, so, you know, tell me about chemistry.
I ask the chemistry teacher, tell me about chemistry.
Well, you, in terms of experts.
So you know chemistry, right? Yeah. Right. Are you fluent in chemistry?
Have you memorized the periodic table?
Right. You know, have you balanced out? I don't know what the formulas are. Have you balanced out elements, you know, balanced your elements out? So I just thought that she was like, wow. So I'm like, should I take this wow as a compliment? Because I want to think the higher of people. Or, seriously, this is a microaggression. It's wowing you. And so then that makes me question then too, the fact that I'm a Black woman who speaks Spanish really shouldn't be an anomaly. Cuba, Puerto Rico, New York. So are we seriously even having this conversation? So I think that that confrontation, even though we are yes, being educated in very high numbers, still it's not good enough. And I think that that's the switch for us as Black women to say that we need to create a new standard. Because we'll never be good enough. And so I love how Viola Davis said she just is not going to tolerate the BS. So she's created her own company. And I'm like, yes.
That's what I was going to say. I feel like we just have to create our own space. Because, you know, you have to have people in power to be able to make space. And there's just, you know, like
Michael
talked about the Black men or men in general just not really being there to support Black women. So we don't have that support. And those are the people who have been in power positions have been the men. And now that Black men are being more represented in positions of power, they're not making space for Black women. So we have to create our own space and then bring each other along. I feel like that's probably going to be our saving grace.
I think the lag comes from a lot of things. So I can speak for my huge tribe of Black women who are my friends and my family. There are a couple different things that happen. A lot of Black women who get advanced degrees are not necessarily in fields where they're going to make a ton of money. And they knew that going into it to begin with, whether it's social work, whether it's teaching or, you know, this.
Or overrepresented in helping professions.
Correct. Exactly. Mm. And see, I knew that and I was just talking about the people I know. Thank you for that.
Because we're always doing emotional labor for
correct.
People.
Correct.
So like, yeah, so why don't I become a social worker?
Exactly.
Because I'm always problem solving for
exactly.
others.
Exactly. And then if you look at, you know, I have the friends who are the physicians and the lawyers and, you know, all of those get all the fancy degrees from all the right schools and it's still not enough. Mm-hmm. When they walk into those spaces and you get the wows and they are microaggressions. And then at what point are you just like, I'm done? So there was about four or five of them. They dubbed themselves team quit your job. And they were just quitting jobs because they have the kind of degrees where they're going to, you know, the kind of educations, the pedigree, the job.
They're going to make experience. Money.
They're going to make, exactly. They're going to make some money.
Because they make the money.
Correct. But then at the same time, it's like you can't float like that indefinitely.
Yeah.
You know, if you did go to that fancy school, you went to Columbia or Harvard or wherever, you got that MBA, you're thrust into something, another space that you're completely unprepared for. And a lot of times, a lot of, especially Black women who are attorneys, drop out of that field so quickly. Again, this is just my world. I don't have statistics. I'm just sharing with you my experiences because they just can't deal with the culture. You know, a couple of them were mothers before, you know, had their kids while they were in law school. The partners did not understand that at all. They didn't understand I need to leave to go take care of. And then it was turned into just very uncomfortable things that turned, that probably started the whole team quit your job. Yeah. So, you know, you can, that, again, unconscious biases in the workplace, you just don't know which way to go.
Yeah. When we talk about lagging behind, I think you have to, we have to factor in the fact that some of the people who are not lagging behind have generational wealth on their side, have access to capital on their side, have access to credit on their side.
Yeah.
Even when Black people, male or female, manage to get the degrees, manage to get the prestige and the positions, they may be the only one or one of the handful within their family and the paycheck. And so while Kevin and Becky might be able to go and invest that money from their salary into their next business venture or into that next house or into that next thing that's going to make wealth, we're spending money taking care of our mom. We're spending money putting our niece through college. We're raising the kid who went back to right, like the second we make it, we're the one that. Right. And I say this to someone with a master's degree as one of the only people my, you know, who made it. I'm glad to see that there are other cousins who've come up. Thank God. yes, please, hallelujah. But yeah, our money isn't just ours.
Neither is our credit.
Right. Can you co-sign?
But
what?
It would be different if we had a plan for that so that you could, there was a strategy behind it. You know, if we do have to use one person's credit, you know, as long as there's a plan and then everybody is building and establishing,
like
you know,
the
that
other
would be.
Because I've noticed like the Chaldeans or Nigerians who come over or Asian Americans who come over, it's like they have a plan. Like they have a system. So it's like, we're all going to stay in this space. Okay. And we're going to strategize this money that's coming in. So maybe we'll start up. Cause I remember getting my nails done at a shop, at a Vietnamese shop. And my tech was saying that they came in from California because they opened up a shop in California. I'm just here to help get things started here.
Yeah. Wow.
So I'm like, okay. Franchise. So they're thinking really. Strategic
or change.
I think this might apply to, we've had Damian Ellis on. Damian Ellis is, does a lot with Black businesses in Detroit specifically. And I think it's called Social Scene, S-O-U-L-C-I-A-L. Brilliant guy. Used to work for Comerica, was high up in their company for a little bit, and then decided to focus on Black businesses and kind of building this generational wealth. And the groups that you pointed out, interestingly enough, I think are very community-based to the point of sacrifice. And we often point out the Black community, but I think that the Black community is community in a way, but also very, very autonomous in another way. Case in point, there was a family, Black family, that decided that they were going to buy a house and they were all going to live in this house together, like a big-ass house. It was all like split up and everything. And my first inclination when I looked at that, and this family is rich, right? Because all the money that they're saving by moving to this big house together, they're saving a lot of money. They're sacrificing for each other. My thought is, I like my privacy. When this is done, I get to go home. I get to be in my space. Right. If my wife and I want to do anything, I don't have to worry about anybody on the other end of the house hearing anything like that. You know, we want our space. We want our autonomy. And so when I talk to people of different ethnic backgrounds, I used to work at Verizon Wireless. I work with this girl. She told me that, and we were working commission. She told me my first two checks of the month, she lived at home, and it was expected that she would live at home until she got married. So she lived at home. She's making a lot of money. And she said, my first two checks, I give to my parents. And then the last check is our commission check. And she was like one of the highest salespeople in the company. So that commission check was plenty. She could live off
but
the
between. But also sounds like motivation.
Right. And so she was doing that, but there was still that communal view. I mean, there was a bunch of other people at the company. They were like, there's no way I would give my parents. I don't want to give my parents $10 because they're not going to give it back, right? But she's got the sacrificial view. And I think that that is something that plagues the Black community is there is a desire, there are quantifiable ideas. But I don't know that there's the willingness to sacrifice. to that level that some of these other communities do. I don't know.
But there's part of there's a historical piece of this too. Like we have been here since day one of America,
and so whether we wanted
to or not, and we have absorbed the values of the culture throughout the centuries in a way that people who are just getting here, or maybe two generations here. Have not, and only we didn't have access to any of the benefits, right? Well, like, so I mean, we absorbed the individuality.
Yes and no. So if you look at a lot of things, you could look at a lot of the different groups. If you look at Asians are almost always considered to be entirely white enculturated in America. Like they adapt to the culture very, very, very well.
But they're still colonialism. Existed also in Asia as well.
Maybe, but it's...
So it's like, it's not it's that it's new.
They adapt to any culture that they move into. It might be something part and parcel to Asian culture, I don't know, but they assimilate very, very, very well. And then they do very, very, very well. There's obviously the history of racism here that is much longer for us than...
That if we integrated, that we were going to get something better. I think that there's, you know, during segregation, there was Black businesses and there was... I mean, Berry Gordy's Motown came about because his family all put money together in a pot together. And the family had to agree collectively that if you wanted to take money out of this collective pot, that you were how you were going to pay it back. Yeah. And that was how Motown got funded. It was a family who kept giving money to a pot that they would borrow from for business ventures. So,
and I have a friend that
go ahead.
I had a friend that practiced that with his family, and I thought it was completely odd when he, you know, we were out driving, and he's like, his phone was just ringing constantly, and I'm like. And he's like, well, you know, his family members were calling him to basically get permission to make purchases. And I thought that was the strangest thing. But, you know, and we're having this conversation, that kind of collective work really, you know what I'm saying? That is probably more ideal than everybody.
It, right?
Yeah.
And there's not anybody who does that is not doing well that I have seen. It's a question of do we want to do that?
Executed properly, right? So I don't know how I want to approach this, but I think that you may see that those models practiced in Caribbean or African communities as well. I feel like that's swiftly changing. I think that, and I can't tell you why, right? And I don't know if it's absorbing American
Western culture.
I don't know. Even with people who of Black families that are mixed with Black people from all over the place. Panama, and I'm thinking of a specific family. Of course, I'm not going to say their name. We're talking about Black Panamanians, Bahamians, Cubans, very mixed, but all Black family. Some things went wrong. There was a Ray Ray in the midst. Everybody was on the bank account. And some things go wrong. And then after that, like you've ruined anything that could happen for generations after that. So they're just, it's just properly executed. And I hear these stories in every community, right? So there is that guilt that also that can be that different communities experience, whether you're Black from America, the South, you know, the continent, the Caribbean, or if you're Asian and this expectation to help your family. But I agree with you when you say there has to be a purpose for this. If you want me to co-sign because you want to drive a new car and you want to be fly, I'm not co-signing for you to drive a better car than me. No, I'm not doing that.
And why would you buy something that depreciates that much right when you drive off the lot?
The second you drive off. Right. Yeah, I mean, like, think about what you're asking people to do. So with the people who do get themselves together, get their credit together, have a decent paycheck. Think about what you're asking them for. Nobody wants to feel like they're contributing to just foolishness or things that aren't going to reap any fruit going down the line. Or, you know, where's your skin in the game? Are you on this loan too? Can you just disappear and this bill is left for me. Right. I know so many people who found themselves in that situation. So, you know, think about it. There has to be a response. And where are you getting your values from? Are you still getting them from your family? Or are you seeing other things in the culture that you're choosing to adopt in those? So it just gets so sticky and messy. So I don't think it's that people don't want to work together. It's like everybody has to be on the same page. We have to be of one accord. Otherwise, and don't count my money for me.
I think there is something distinctly American. It's almost like a martyrdom. I'd rather fail as an individual than make it by depending on other people.
Yes.
Because that makes me weak.
Self-made.
Yeah, everybody wants to, even if it means failing while being self-made, they can say, well, I did it on my own. I failed. I went bankrupt on my own. Yeah, you did it all that on your own. But it would be, this is where Americans fail. One of the many ways Americans fail is that we need to take from other cultures. We need to take that working together, that communal atmosphere that is working obviously well in all these other cultures we've already mentioned. But damn it, anyway, we're going to say, no, I'd rather fail because that's the American way of, you know,
rugged individualism.
Self-made. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'll let you close out this question.
Okay. So this was something else that I was thinking of driving here. This idea of I can do it by myself, and the way I think us as black women wear it as a badge of honor that we can do so many things without any help. I don't need a man. I don't have anybody. You know, we brag about how we work 2-3 jobs and take care of our kids all by ourselves. Nobody help me. That's celebrated. And I really feel like we kind of, well, at least I'm speaking about my life. I don't have the statistics, but the women that I know, and even I find myself doing it, being all too proud of being able to manage on my own when it really should be like, no, I need to reach out, up, down, all around, and just really try to make this a community effort. You know, speaking of my family or people that are, you know, part of my community.
Okay. So an upcoming women's march in California has been canceled recently for fear that the participants were overwhelmingly white. What are your thoughts about black women navigating the political spaces such as the Women's March and the Me Too movement? Are the voices of black women important to these conversations?
Absolutely important. The Me Too movement was started by a black woman, in case anyone didn't know that.
Toronto Blurk.
Yes. And do we have equal space? No, we do not. And is it important that we are represented? Yes, absolutely.
And to your point, Tati, I think that we have to look at the historical paradigm of the whole woman's suffrage. That in the movement of women's equality, it was for white women. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who are not familiar with black fraternities and sororities, it was Delta Sigma Theta's women who were marching behind the white men. So you can march. But you have to march behind. So there's a huge, I think, empathy piece that's
I tell
missing.
Kent and Steve that they can march, but they're going to march behind. all the time. All the time.
So and that is why we do not march.
So I think that in this movement for equity and for justice, that we have to begin to look at if there is a wrong, it's wrong. LGBTQ, then I have to stand in that same solidarity because it's wrong. Mm-hmm. We have to move past, okay, well, no, that's just a black thing. Or no, it's wrong. And so them canceling might be a move in the right direction because it's in my circles of black women, there's still a salt in the wound about not ever being included. And that crux of the whole women's suffrage is still that wrong, still not an atonement, if you will. And then I think there was a few years ago where that campaign went out, I'd rather die than be a slave. That campaign, I think Meryl Streep had this t-shirt on. It was a couple of other white actors. And so there was like this big blowback, but still never a real apology. So if we're really going to move forward, and maybe it's not your intent to offend, but still apologize for the fact that you even hurt someone. Let's just even start there.
I feel like this was scapegoating. The Women's March has had come out with multiple narratives about why they were canceling, including that black women organizers wouldn't abdicate their relationships or publicly disavow Louis Farrakhan. You know, I've heard every excuse other than we didn't want to do better. Right? Like, so I'm going to take up my marbles and I'm going to go home.
Oh, you mean we were afraid the crowd was going to be small?
Right? Okay. You know, like, rather than do better, figure out how they can fix it and not require all of these different demands, like demands on Black women activists that they weren't demanding of themselves. They were just like, oh, we're just going to cancel the whole thing. And we're going to blame the Black women activists for spoil mm-hmm. sport. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah, I think that further salt in the wound. And while we had third wave feminism to begin with, you know, and it's because of stuff like this. And it keeps mm-hmm. happening.
And it keeps happening.
And it keeps happening.
It's the offense that doesn't
end. Can I see your thoughts?
I don't know why, but I'm stuck. Just
okay. We can move forward. Steve's gonna ask the next question.
Okay.
This is like the one question I wanted to ask this whole show.
So he passed it on over here.
I did pass it on over.
That's really the whole reason I'm for the show.
No,
for
I think he wants to be part of this.
No, because I do want to have this conversation. So I will ask this next one. Okay. Steve, ask something. So what are your thoughts on Black men who date out? And so there's more to that. So does interracial dating between a Black man and a white woman specifically make you feel any sort of way? And does it make any kind of statement when a Black woman dates a white man?
Why do I care who a Black man dates if he's not my man? I mean, help me out. Is it my business? I come from the mind your business era from, you know, maybe it's old school, but I don't see how that's any of my business.
Okay. I guess I should explain where this question comes
from.
Okay. Give some context. So, and maybe it's because I do care too much what people think of me. I don't know.
Okay.
But, you know, so my wife is white, and I've been raised around predominantly white people, right? So I didn't go searching for people who weren't around. I just found who was close to me. So married my wife, love her. She's had my back. It's great. But there have been people that I've talked to that when I was dating, like if they saw that on an online profile, equal opportunity offender, because it didn't really matter to me. I've dated every shade under the sun. But if certain Black women saw that, they were like, I can't date you. You're not a real Black man because you date anything other than our sisters. It's like, oh, I didn't know that I was relationally owned before I was relationally owned. But there are some women who feel a certain kind of way about that, my sister included. She has said, when you date a white woman, what does that say about your mom's beauty? Do you not think that your mother is beautiful or that your sister is beautiful? And I'm like, I'm not attracted to my mother and I'm not attracted to my sister, but I got what she was getting at.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of Black women who feel like, hey, this is the standard of beauty. White women are the standard of beauty. We have backed you. You have not backed us. This is the big one. And when you get successful after we've helped you, then you go and you get yourself a white trophy wife,
mm-hmm.
right? And you'll see many, many successful men, especially in Hollywood, who are married to white women. And there are a lot of Black women who feel some kind of way about that. And then I'm starting to hear speech about Black women saying, I'm going to go get myself a good white man so I can have good credit, right? So there's that. We talk about that a lot. And it's kind of a joke, but also not necessarily untrue.
First of all, our credit is great.
I know. We don't need his credit, but you don't want somebody fucking up your credit, so
no,
there's
exactly.
That. That was me swearing, just so we're clear.
All good.
And later, that's you editing.
I cannot put you on my credit card.
I know, I get it.
Tati said, I am not co-signing.
Hashtag no co-sign.
So I don't want to take away, while I disagree with that perspective, I don't want to take away from the fact that there are many Black women whose feelings are very hurt or feel a certain kind of way when they're walking through a mire and they see me with my wife, or they see me out on the street, or they see any Black man who is not with them while they're struggling and feeling or not struggling, but haven't found the one.
Being alone.
Or they have found the one and they still feel some kind of way about it.
I think that a lot of Black men have preconceived expectations of Black women, right? And this is coming from what people have told me. Mm-hmm. I'm by no means an expert. I'm not making any blanket statements, and I'm not speaking for every Black man. I have been told that there are things that they automatically expect from us. Oh, you have an attitude, or mm-hmm. oh, you're aggressive, or oh, you're this, if you're that. Then if you I don't even know how to respond to that. Oh. You know, these
that's,
are
that's black men who couch their attraction to white women in the negative things they see in white in black women.
Okay, help me out. So
like, let's, oh, I see a white woman as more, I see white women as more docile. See, this is why I'm dating white. This is why I don't date black chicks. Mm-hmm. Y'all so aggressive.
Mm-hmm. I just like, had that conversation. So with much my attitude. Son, who's 18? He'll be 19 soon because he recently started seeing. A young lady who is not black. And, you know, I asked, you know, how, you know, we just had a conversation about, you know, how that came about and how they met and do they have, you know, does he find that he has, you know, something in common with her? He also has dated black girls as well. And, you know, he even said, he's like, well, mom, you know, she's just easier to date. Like, black girls have attitude. And, you know, he just went and did the usual list that, you know, all those stereotypes. Yeah. Wow. All those stereotypes that are out there about us. And I'm like, well, wow, right. I'm black.
Right. See, and that's where the question comes from, I think.
Yes. I'm only irritated by the, I mean, cause this isn't a phenomenon. This is exclusively heterosexual. Black gay men feel away when black gay men are seen on the arm of white men, which is the predominant image of white gay culture. You do see, like, you generally see a white guy with a black guy. Rarely do you see black men with black men. So this same thing comes up, though there's more of a historical precedent for it, obviously, in the heterosexual context. I'm only irritated when the person goes out of their way to come up with excuses. Mm-hmm. You like what you like, period, full stop. The second you start saying why the other person ain't worthy, I am now in my feels, right? Yes, because then it's not, rooted in you like what you like, and you just happen to come across this person that you fell in love with.
Yeah.
And I have interracial marriages up and down my family line, including my sister who's recently married a white man. And so all of my nieces and nephews are going to be biracial, like at this, except one, because one sister married black, two sisters married black, and two married white. And so this is, for me, I only care again, like when people make excuses, I am disheartened to hear that an 18-year-old has gotten to that. But to me, that also speaks to patriarchy. Why is the expectation that somebody is going to be submissive to you, that somebody's not going to hold you accountable, that someone's not going to call you on your stuff? Mm-hmm. Why are you desirous of someone you can control? And what does that say about you and your politics? And it's not about your son. No. but in general, brothers, if you're looking for somebody that you can use as a footstool, if she has to be on her knees in order for you to feel tall, there is a problem. And the problem is not with her. Mm-hmm. It is with you.
This was something else to add another layer
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just found out there is a show right behind us, so we have 5 minutes. So we don't get to everything else. Okay. Might have to do a part two to this. Yeah. I don't know. But continue.
He also explained that, you know, this other young lady who's not black doesn't necessarily doesn't embody this or embrace the same culture. So he's like, well, you know, black girls, you know, they do the same things that I do. So, like, they know about Snapchat and all this. So, you know, he's up to all kind of foolery where he feels like this other young lady is not really into these things, you know, because it's not a part of her culture. So she, you know, basically can't call him. And I'm like, Ray, like, this is crazy. But this is, you know, this is their reality. So I just really found that very interesting.
That's sad.
Yeah. It is. Well, I wish we had more time because there are
I'm
questions.
Working on them.
There are questions I wanted to ask about abortion in the black community and adoption in the black community, because next week we're going to be talking about transracial adoption, which should be interesting. We will have pretty much all white parents who have chosen to adopt black kids out of the black community. So it'll be an interesting conversation. But unfortunately, we are out of time. I wish we had more time. But I do want to thank all of our guests for being here today. And thank you for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. If you want to have us out to your college, university, small group, whatever, and have this conversation live, you can email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com. And of course, you can find us wherever great podcasts are listened to. So Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and of course, the Podcast Detroit app. And we will see you next week.